From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, the lame duck State House passes an A through F school grading bill, which would apply to schools around the state.
This is colonialism. This is anti-democratic. It was done in the middle of the night. No stakeholder engagement.
Detroit News business columnist Daniel Howes on GOP bills passed in lame duck.
I think we see a lot of petty politicking, but more importantly, I think we see politics practiced today as the exercise of naked, raw power.
And after years in foster care, how it feels to age out when you turn 18.
I didn't know that I was going to graduate. I didn't see that next day because I was so worried about, you know, where I was moving next or if I was going to be getting kicked out.
Those stories and much more today for you on Stateside. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Schools in Michigan could start getting their own report cards. Early this morning, the State House passed House Bill 5526. It creates an A through F grading system for Michigan schools in several areas. Opponents, including many in the education community, say constantly changing how this state evaluates its schools is a recipe for chaos. GOP Representative Tim Kelly is the bill's sponsor. He calls the opposition hysteria, and he says the goal is to make evaluations easier for parents and schools.
I think that this is going to prove to be a great assist to Michigan schools.
With us now, Dr. Nikolai Vitti, superintendent of the Detroit Public Schools Community District. Welcome, Dr. Vitti.
Well, thank you. Thank you for having me. Important conversation that we're going to have.
Dr. Vitti, Detroit was ordered to come up with its own grading system as part of the 2016 School Rescue Plan, and you've been part of the commission crafting that system, and now here comes this bill to cover the entire state and supersede yours. What was your reaction when you heard this was making its way through the state legislature?
Extremely disappointed. We all feel right now in Detroit, as far as those that have been working on a grading system, that the rug was pulled underneath us. We've been working extremely hard on difficult work and work that we are committed to doing. We believe in accountability. We know that our schools have to improve. We know our children are talented and gifted, and their performance on state assessments, for example, don't reflect that gifted and talented ability. And so we were toward the end of the process of putting together a rating system, a one-letter grade system that was going to apply to traditional public schools and charter schools. And the beauty of that process was that it was representative of multiple stakeholders in Detroit, people that you wouldn't think would get together to actually grade schools. We had union representation, we had parent representation, we had business representation, myself as a superintendent, we had charter leaders involved, the city. You can't think of a more diverse group of people coming together with a grading system that was due to be implemented based on this year's performance, and a letter grade was going to be released in the fall, a one-letter grade system, so A through F, and having come from Florida and worked through a school grading system, I was very optimistic that this was going to lead to different practice. And that's what accountability should be about, is changing practice, holding people accountable, but also giving space to recognize growth and improvement. So you change practice, you change what's happening in classroom and schools, and we lack that throughout Michigan right now and in Detroit. What's disheartening about this is that the statute is already clear that we needed to create a grading system. We did that, and now it's as if all of that work doesn't matter. We were clearly disrespected. We were disregarded. No one called us. No one engaged us. No one asked about what we thought of this. That includes the mayor's office and everyone linked to the CEC process. So it's just another example of how legislators in Lansing have imposed reform on Detroit without actually engaging the stakeholders. And time again, we have history to show us it doesn't work. So at what point are people going to learn from history and stop repeating it? Because when you impose reform on stakeholders, they don't see it as theirs, they don't embrace it, and it's an imposition. And this might sound extreme, but this is colonialism. This is anti-democratic. It was done in the middle of the night, no stakeholder engagement. the Republican Party nationally and even at the state level is looking more and more like an autocratic government that does not care about what anyone says, and they feel like they have all the right answers and that they are doing right for everyone, even when no one agrees with them. It's a horrible time in our country in large and in the state that we have to have legislation done in the middle of the night with no stakeholder engagement.
And I should remind everybody, when you referred to the CEC, that is the Community Education Commission. You've been working on this system, and you're supposed to vote next Tuesday on that system that has been tailor-made for Detroit schools. With this House bill, one size fits all, to cover the entire state, what do you think this is going to mean for your district, for students in Detroit?
Yeah, and I want to make clear, too, in the accountability system that we were creating, we were going to have F schools in Detroit. When do you think you would have heard the superintendent supporting a grading system where some schools were going to inevitably be F schools? And charter leaders and district leaders were agreeing that we needed an accountability system for the city. That's what reform looks like. So my concern with the proposed grading system is, one, I have no confidence at all that MDE has the capacity or the resources to even get this off the ground. They're resistant. They are opposing the legislation. So again, we have another entity, the legislature, that's imposing an accountability system on a department that doesn't even want it. So you can imagine what the people in the system and how they're going to react to implementing it. The other thing is, no one's going to understand anything about the accountability system. It's five grades for one school. Who's going to figure out what those five grades mean? Is one mean more than the other? One of the challenges we've had with accountability systems in Michigan is that they're incoherent. They don't really speak to the health of a school because there are so many indicators. And so with five letter grades for one school, no one's going to make sense out of that. And then lastly, there's no recognition of the challenges in urban school districts within the model. You can't look at every school the same, disregard poverty, disregard English learner status, disregard special needs, and just simply say all schools in Michigan are going to be graded the same. That in of itself could be overcome, but the main problem is not recognizing growth. We've had a system here in Detroit that's run for over 10 years by emergency managers that didn't train teachers, didn't pay teachers, didn't invest in facilities, didn't have upgraded curriculum and data systems to serve children. And then this accountability system that emphasizes proficiency or on grade level performance is going to be imposed. And all you're going to do is create a self-fulfilling prophecy through the ideology of Lansing to say that schools are failure. And they're not failures. They are serving children. We need to improve. But the right accountability system holds schools accountable, has the right balance of at grade level performance and growth. And then over time, the system can move to more proficiency when we have time to build capacity and hold people accountable. But not only was the process wrong-headed, but the product is faulty. And I think that's important to note. The process was not engaging. It was not transparent. And then the product itself is faulty. It's not going to work. It's not going to work because teachers, principals, parents, communities don't believe in this. And even if you want to believe in it, it's developed in a way that doesn't allow people to grow over time and acknowledge the work that they're already doing. Change cannot be imposed on people, especially when there's a history of failure. And that's what we have as far as the relationship between the legislature and school districts throughout Michigan.
If you've just joined us, we're talking to the superintendent of the Detroit Public Schools Community District, Dr. Nicolai Vitti, about the fact that the Michigan House has approved this A through F school grading system after a very, very long overnight session in Lansing. You came, as you mentioned, from Florida, which has a grading system. How did you see that work in Florida?
Well, it moved the school districts in Florida to a place of reflection on practice, which leads to greater performance. You had an accountability system that was the same throughout Florida. It was easy to understand, and it motivated teachers, parents, principals to do things differently in order to raise student achievement. And that's what you want from an accountability system. I'll say the accountability system in Florida was not perfect, but I will tell you that it improved practice. It held people accountable to improving performance for students. And I believe that what we were creating in Detroit would have led to that same kind of positive change because it was simple to understand. It analyzed schools based on where they are now, and it would hold schools accountable to performance now, but it would have allowed for improvement over time. You know, the metrics that are part of this proposed bill and grading system aren't even about the growth of individual children. Growth, for example, is determined by how the growth of one student is compared to other students throughout the state. That doesn't even make sense. Teachers are motivated by improving the performance of individual children in their classroom. And so they should be held accountable to that. So should the school and the district. But when you have a growth model that compares one child to other group of children, you're not really focusing on the individual child. That's what teachers and parents want, and that's what children need, not constantly comparing one group of kids to another group of kids. That doesn't benefit anybody.
What should lawmakers be focusing on? What would help you?
In this particular situation, it would to recognize what was already in state statute regarding our necessity to create an accountability system in Detroit. So to make this right, it would be to acknowledge the statute that's already there, acknowledge the work that's happened already in Detroit around the school grading system, let us move forward with what we've already developed, and that could be a model for other urban districts throughout the state, and I would argue should be a model for all schools throughout the state of Michigan. I would argue that our system, if put against the system that's being proposed by the legislature, our system would be appreciated by practitioners. And I want to be clear, there are practitioners, even in the Detroit context, that are against the school grading system. It's not as if principals and teachers and students and parents are celebrating the idea of grading schools here in Detroit. That's a hard transition to embrace because of how the state has done the district wrong over the years. But we've been able to build confidence because it's a Detroit-developed accountability system that was, again, going to even grade schools as F to A. So it's not as if we were going to give everyone an A, a B, or a C. We were ready to grade schools low based on this system. So I would say actually listen to people in Detroit that are doing the work, that have done the work. Let us keep our system. And statewide, you need to engage people to better understand what this is about and why you want to do this, or it's never going to get off the ground. And statewide, we're going to waste time trying to implement an accountability system that's needed that will never be implemented.
Dr. Nicolae Vitti, Detroit Public Schools Community District Superintendent, thank you for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Bill sponsor Representative Tim Kelly did not respond to our interview requests. We also asked Michigan Department of Education press contacts if they could confirm the agency opposes this legislation. We did not immediately hear back. Coming up on Stateside, what would one of the founders of the conservative movement think of politics in 2018? The teachings of Michigan's Russell Kirk after the break. Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. 52 years ago this week, the world lost Walter Elias Disney. He, of course, was the animator and entrepreneur who built an entertainment empire launched in 1928 by a cheerful little mouse whose name was meant to be Mortimer, but who wound up named Mickey. Walt Disney's death became the source of some very strange urban legends. University of Michigan medical historian and PBS contributor Dr. Howard Markell is back with us. So Walt Disney was only 65?
Yeah. Now, the lifespan in 1966 was markedly less than it is today, of course. Walt was a chronic smoker, many, many packs of unfiltered cigarettes a day. And, you know, from early on, like when he was in World War I as an ambulance driver. And his peers or his colleagues knew when he was coming down the hall because Walt had such a hacking cough, you know, that smoker's cough. So he had a lot of issues related to chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, emphysema, and so on.
And toward the end, I remember this because I was a regular watcher of that Sunday night Wonderful
Best
World
part of the
Disney.
Week.
It
Best
was
part of the week.
Followed by Ed Sullivan.
That's right. That's right.
But we digress. Viewers were noticing because he would always do an introduction to the show. He wasn't looking good.
Yeah, I mean, Walt, in his Midwestern, unassuming way, used his story for his television show in a way that's become textbook now for CEOs of all kinds of businesses. But Walt was avuncular, and he was, after all, Walt Disney, who introduced us, our children, our grandchildren, to so many neat stories and characters. So he did the intro to The Wonderful World of Color on NBC Sunday nights, and he began to look rather haggard. And he also – his voice was kind of getting gruff and sore. So people – how you doing, Walt? Fan letters. How you doing, Walt?
Ultimately, it led to a trip onto the operating room table.
Well, yes. He went across the street. classic mogul. They're too busy to get sick. There was a hospital directly across the street from the Disney Studios in Burbank. He had a regular x-ray, nothing fancy, and they found a walnut-sized mass in the left lung. So they he went back to the studio, cleared his desk, finished a few things, and then went back to have a large portion of his left lung removed.
What else was found then?
Problem was it was bronchogenic cancer, and this is a fancy way of calling it lung cancer. He also had enough spread or metastases into the lymph nodes and other parts of his body, which is – particularly in 1966, that was a death knell. There was very little anyone could do for lung cancer if they had a lot of time and notice. Yeah. But this stage was really an end game.
And he did try to struggle back and keep working. But as you say in your piece here, the chemotherapy drained him, the cobalt x-ray.
Oh, yeah. Cobalt x-ray makes radiation look like a trip to the beach. Mm-hmm. I mean, the early x-ray treatments were strong, too strong. They had not yet figure that out.
So within a month, he was gone.
Yeah, he died of circulatory collapse is what the death certificate says. He probably had a massive heart attack. You know, you have less lung capacity because of the removal of it. You have cancer. You don't know what that's doing. The strain on his heart, years of smoking, atherosclerosis, the stresses of being a Hollywood mogul, et cetera, led to his demise.
So December 15th, 1966, he dies. But then things take a weird turn. Tell us about how these strange urban legends began, what they are.
Well, really very early on, a few months after he died, some reporter for one of those tabloids claimed he had gotten into St. Joseph's Hospital. That's where Walt was being treated. Got himself an orderly outfit. Sounds like a Seinfeld episode.
It does.
Broke into a storage room where he saw Walt suspended in a cryogenic chamber filled with liquid nitrogen. So Disney on ice. So
Disney on ice. And you Google that and that does pop up that, oh, yes. That legend. So that persisted that Walt was cryogenically frozen waiting for a cure?
Yes. And there was a book that came out right around that time. It's a lot more science fiction than science. You are free to get an expert on cryogenics. I'm not that guy. But I don't think they're thawing out people anytime soon.
But we do know Slugger Ted Williams and his son John Henry were frozen, weren't they?
Well, that's even more complicated. They say his head was frozen and the body is somewhere else. And now there's been – I looked it up. There's some concern that the head has been removed. I don't know.
Yeah.
But it's a very weird theory and – it has persisted forever. It was even used in a couple of – there's a lot of Disney biographies. And in a couple not so reliable ones, they advanced this theory as if it were fact.
Is research still happening on cryogenics? Is that still something that some researchers are saying someday we should be able to freeze someone and keep them on ice until they find a cure?
Well, I think you have to separate – I'm sure there are someone who is saying it would be great if we could freeze somebody and thaw them.
Yeah.
I'm sure at cryogenics – plants or institutes or whatever, they are doing work on it. I am completely ignorant of what might or might not be done, and I am prepared to meet my maker when that day comes.
But meantime, if we talk about Disney on Ice, we are not talking about Walter Elias Disney.
No,
we're talking about skaters.
No, let's end that.
Let
him rest in peace. In fact, he was buried at Forest Lawn. He was cremated and buried, and his daughter said, I don't think Walt even knew about cryogenics, let alone wished to be frozen. It's just nonsense. So I think that's the best source.
So I just as far as that urban legend of cryogenics, just let it go.
Let's hope so. I think we could have this discussion a year from now. It would still be around.
University of Michigan medical historian, Dr. Howard Markell, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Russell Kirk is recognized as one of the most influential thinkers and writers of the 20th century. His 1953 book, The Conservative Mind, was hailed by the New York Times, calling it an intellectual Bible of the conservative movement. And besides being a leading political philosopher, Kirk turned out ghost stories and gothic thrillers. And in a piece for the Historical Society of Michigan, my next guest points to Russell Kirk's Michigan upbringing in shaping a mind that helped to shape conservatism. Gleaves Whitney is the director of the Hauenstein Center for Presidential Studies at Grand Valley State University, and his article is titled Russell Kirk, the Wizard of Macosta. Gleaves, always great to talk with you on Stateside.
Thank you, Cindy.
So tell us, where does Russell Kirk stand in the pantheon of political thinkers?
Well, he was very influential in setting up the post-war conservative movement. He contributed mightily to it through his Conservative Mind and other writings starting in 1953. But I would say he's a different kind of conservative. I think today most people think of conservatism as a sort of the holdover of the Republican country club type member, the titan on Wall Street and that sort of thing. And that certainly is an element of the conservative movement. Russell Kirk was a very different kind of conservative. He was what he would call a Burkean conservative after Edmund Burke, the parliamentarian and political philosopher in Britain as the French Revolution broke out. Russell was also just a tremendously imaginative person. He wrote a lot of fiction. He was interested in living off the land. He was, I think, a conservationist. He was somebody who had socialist friends. For example, he liked Norman Thomas back in the 50s. He loved Eugene McCarthy in the Vietnam War era. When I go out and speak about Russell, people don't realize that a conservative, especially one of the founders of the conservative movement, could have that kind of a profile. But Russell breaks the mold in so many ways.
I know he defined himself as a traditionalist conservatism. What does that actually mean?
It means that you respect what brung you here to this point. I think most conservatives believe that civilization is a pretty fragile achievement. It has to be re-nurtured every generation, or you can start to lose great ground. You know, if the teachers quit teaching, if the preachers quit preaching, if the makers of things quit making things, your civilization can start to fall apart. And you can look at the historical record, as Russell did extensively, the whole world record. And you can see there were about 28 civilizations that existed, and only four of those still survive. So one out of seven civilizations survives; the rest fall off the map. I mean, that's something that will make you sit up straight in your chair. So the conservative's thinking, well, what is it that makes a civilization survive? There's this tension between carrying forward tradition, but the other side of that coin is also being able to adapt and change and progress at a pace that is mindful of the tradition, but adapts to new realities, new pressures that the civilization faces. So even though he's called a traditionalist, he's also very mindful of the needed changes that have to happen for the civilization, for the country to survive.
And in the piece you wrote for the Historical Society of Michigan, you make a case that it was Kirk's Michigan roots in Plymouth and Macosta that inspired his thinking. You put it as the two interior states of Kirk's mind. So let's start with Plymouth. How did that city, that city's history, shape one of Michigan's most famous writers?
Well, Plymouth is very much, first of all, let me point out that both of these communities are really in the center of the old Northwest. If you look at the Northwest Territory that was created in 1787 by the founders of this country, you know, it extended all the way from the, you know, Ohio border with Pennsylvania all the way up to the Mississippi headwaters. So this area where Kirk was right in the center of this large area. It was settled by a large number of New England immigrants who came in from the East Coast as the Erie Canal opened. And it so happened that Plymouth itself was very much settled by Connecticut Yankees and people who held to their roots with Plymouth Rock and all of the legends there. So Plymouth is very much a New England town, and its very origins are New Englandish,
and it looks New Englandish with that beautiful Kellogg Park, the town square.
Exactly, yeah. The town square, which is not technically it's not, you know, geometrically a square, but it's symbolically at the center. It brings people together, and that's sort of the civic republicanism, little r, civic republicanism, that Americans wanted to foster when they were building this country. So there are a lot of things. There's the civic Republican idea of service. So you see that in the war memorials around town. Russell would have, when he walked to school, would have gone by those war memorials to the the fallen soldiers of the Spanish-American War and the Civil War, the Mexican War, that kind of thing. And then you have the town square that brings people together. You have a moral earnestness that he would have seen during the 1930s when there were a lot of philanthropies, charities helping people deal with the fallout from the Great Depression. So Russell was very much oriented to this New England, this austere sense of service to others above self. But then, Plymouth also began to change. Around the beginning of the 20th century, it was attracting railroads and industries. BB guns were manufactured there, for example.
Right.
So it has a lot of other industries that Russell, recognized were providing jobs, but he did not want for the New England roots to be lost in all of that. So he always held in tension that old Plymouth that was founded by those hardy New England settlers with their civic Republican values and virtues, and then the new requirements of the new age to provide jobs and an infrastructure that works for a modern civilization. But he was a traditionalist. He favored the old. He did not want it to disappear. In an age of progress and of rapid change and creative destruction of capitalism, he was saying, what are we losing in the creative destruction that's really precious? It's important for us to be humans in community with one another.
And then how was Plymouth balanced by what he loved about McCosta? Kind of a yin-yang there?
That's exactly right. That's a good way to put it, Cindy. That McCosta, Michigan's up in the steppe country. It's about 200 miles to the northwest of Detroit. McCosta was a lumber town and a frontier town, but once it had been abandoned, once the frontier bypassed it and people left the region and just left sort of the old storefronts and the stump country where all the trees had been cut, there was something very haunting about it to Russell. And he believed that McCosta kept hold of this haunting spirit and inspired many of his ghost stories, as a matter of fact, ghost stories which have been favorably compared to those of Stephen King. And he just thought that there was a silence there that was left in the vacuum of where, the Native Americans had been and had thrived in that wonderful country in the middle of Michigan. Then progress had come and then left the place abandoned, and there was a quality of silence that fascinated Russell. And Russell wanted to give it voice through his short stories and through his traditionalist principles. It was important then for this yin and yang, as you put it, to work together. And I think it did in the inside of his consciousness, to get away from the Detroit metro area in the summer times, go up north, as we say here in Michigan, and be in the wilderness with this kind of ghostly presence of the past.
He got his bachelor's at Michigan State University and then went on to get a master's at Duke and a doctor of letters from St. Andrews in Scotland. And I know he came back to East Lansing to teach at MSU, but there was some kind of rupture, right? Because didn't he break from MSU and kind of spend the rest of his days calling it Cow College or Behemoth University? What happened?
Well, he and President John Hanna came to blows. Russell became very critical of sort of what he called a factory approach to higher education. He said, why do we put these kids, these 18-year-old minds that are so curious, they still have a sense of wonder. Why do we lock them up in a lecture hall with 300, 400 other people? It's dehumanizing. It's not personal. It's not geared to really quality discussion. And that's at the root of education. You need to have that kind of relationship with your fellow students and with the professor to teach each other. And you can't get it from multiple choice exams in a big lecture hall. So he criticized John Hanna's big push to make Michigan State a powerhouse university. He was critical of Michigan State's emphasis on athletics at the time. And the rupture meant that he really wasn't a happy camper, decided to go back to his ancestral home, not in Plymouth, but in McCosta now, where his mother's family had put down roots. And he stayed there for the next four decades writing. But he always used Michigan State. He always held it up as a model of what not to become. I mean, he was insulting to there's no other way to put it. He was insulting to the president of the university, insulting of its goals, and thought that if this is the trend in higher education in America, that we really were going to lose sort of the humanistic perspective that education should instill in us.
Gleaves, Russell Kirk died in 1994. Would he recognize conservative America and the Republican Party of 2018? What do you think he would make of Donald Trump?
I think Russell Kirk would weep. He would sob at what has become of the conservative movement and at some of the political so-called leadership we've had. He would be heartbroken because he was inspired by people like Edmund Burke, whom we've mentioned, by John Adams. If you looked at the founders, Thomas Jefferson, people who had a real humane sense of what the purpose of political community is. How then should we live together? We're a democracy that requires people to be able to discuss issues in a civil way. Our very Constitution requires it by having checks and balances and a federated system. It requires people to tack a little bit toward the center. They're still able to hold their values, of course, but they have to be able to communicate with others in a civil way. Russell was big on civil discourse. His personal friendships with people like Arthur Schlesinger Jr., who was a progressive historian, showed, he demonstrated what it was like to have to come from a different place philosophically, but to be able to sit down, come, let us reason together. Let's discuss what's at stake with our civilization. The name calling, the fact that everything has been dumbed down, the tweets, the rapid fire quips and insults would just, I think, for him, indicate that we have really descended into dangerous territory. I think he has a lot to teach us on the upside of this, Cindy. This is why we should be reading Russell Kirk, because he offers a model of what a conservatism that's not necessarily identical with Republican politics, but what a conservatism should look like and how to restore humane values, how to be able to get along with socialists, yes, socialists like Norman Thomas, and progressives like Arthur Schlesinger Jr. Russell demonstrated this in a very gracious personality, and we all still can learn a lot from him. I know I do personally.
Russell Kirk, The Wizard of Macosta, the article by Gleaves Whitney in the Historical Society of Michigan. Gleaves, of course, director of the Hauenstein Center for Presidential Studies at Grand Valley State University. Gleaves, thank you so very much.
Thank you.
You're listening to Stateside. Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. The clock is running out on lame duck. The Republican-controlled legislature keeps pumping out bills. And Detroit News business columnist Daniel House has a question, and I quote him, "What is it with these people?" Daniel, we've been talking each week for years. I think this is the angriest column I've seen you turn out. You aim that question at the ones still controlling Lansing until January 1st. So what is it with these people? What's your answer?
I don't know. I think we see a lot of petty politicking, but more importantly, I think we see politics practiced today as the exercise of naked, raw power. And, you know, they do things because they can. This Republican legislature and previous Republican legislatures have used lame duck to push through legislation that metaphorically enables them to stand their boot on the neck of labor in this state. And I think it's done nothing but radicalize the other side. And when they are back in power under a new governor, and essentially labor will be and will have a seat at the table in the governor's office again, I think things are going to be a little bit different. You know, the other thing that strikes me about this is that this is more about imposition. It's not about persuasion. Mm. And when you can't persuade people that you're making why your argument is a good one, why your policies would be more beneficial to the state, but you have the power to impose it, I'm reminded of a phrase when I was writing that column. I didn't use it, but my father used to say, "A man convinced against his will is of the same opinion still." And I think that really applies here. That there are policies that get pushed through at the end of the session that are potentially deleterious and certainly adversarial, because if they weren't adversarial, they wouldn't have saved them till lame duck.
Well, for example, I want to tick a few boxes here to get your thoughts. The bills weakening the power of the next governor, next secretary of state, and next attorney general, all Democrats. Go.
Well, I think it speaks for itself, doesn't it? It basically says we're going to change the rules because we don't trust them to do what they need to do. Look, both sides can look at the voters and say and come up with all sorts of examples of why this whole notion of, well, the voters have spoken, therefore the voters are right, is wrong in their opinion. You can have Republicans can do that. You can have Democrats can do that. But the fact of the matter is if you live and die by the vote and if you are in this political machine, that's kind of the last word. And, you know, we have to kind of recognize that. And, you know, it's a bit of a hackneyed phrase, but it's true. Elections have consequences. So not only do you have to persuade, why isn't it more important to persuade? I think it's also important to run better candidates. And I don't think there's any question that the Republican nominee for this governor's race was a weak candidate.
New civil service job for the state's chief medical executive, Dr. Eden Wells. Go.
Oh, just. I saw that in our newsroom, and I sent a note to a couple of my colleagues, and I said, this is absurd. I mean, you have somebody who is an appointee who clearly has been bound over for trial, as I understand it, but who clearly would be in the frame with a new governor and could easily be fired. And here in the waning days of the year, they convert her job, give her another job in the civil service, which essentially gives her civil service protections. Doesn't make it impossible for the next governor to dismiss her, but certainly makes it more complicated and probably a little more protracted. I just think it slaps the people of Flint in the face. It says that the whole notion of accountability is cooked, and you know, we're going to defy it. And I think it speaks for itself.
Daniel, what are your sources in the business community? What are you hearing about what they feel about what's playing out now during lame duck?
You know, I don't know to what extent they really pay that close of attention, to be honest with you. And if it's not, if they're not tax bills, if they're not things that are directly impinging on or influencing the business environment in Michigan, I suspect that it's less important to them. One of the things I think is pretty clear by this election is that they were already looking past the election. I think there was an assumption that was baked in that Gretchen Whitmer was going to be the next governor, that we were headed for divided government. And you could make the argument that divided government could be in some ways better. I think one of the things we've seen is as Republicans have been in control, and this happens any time a party is in control for as long a period as 8 years, they start to get sloppy. And as a result, things start to lose their momentum.
And final few seconds, how do you think the relentless positive action governor will deal with this blizzard of bills he has to go through?
Well, I would think he would. He certainly has the veto pen to be able to say, I'm not going to be a party to this. Now, this is a guy who says, look, civility is important. I mean, when you talk to him about his legacy, he'll talk about the legacy of civility, a legacy of relentless positive action, of not demonizing your enemies. Well, some of these bills that are going to land on his desk potentially could be, quote, demonizing the adversaries. And I think we're going to get a chance to see kind of what Rick Snyder is made of finally, as these are his final moves, and these issues are not going to come before him, at least, ever again.
Detroit News business columnist Daniel Howes. Daniel, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Michigan is not doing enough to connect kids aging out of the foster care system with educational assistance and vocational training. In fact, our state is dead last in the country. All of that, according to a recent report from the Annie E. Casey Foundation. When we spoke with children's advocate Matt Gillard yesterday, he told us it isn't that Michigan doesn't know how to help these kids.
We have some programs here in Michigan that work fairly well and are set up and are good. They're just not funded at the level that we need to be able to service all the kids that are in the system.
So let's take a look at the outcomes for teens in the foster care system when they're connected with the help they need. Ariel Duncan is an 18-year-old freshman at Wayne State University, and her story is an example of what can happen when the support, the guidance, the resources are all there. An abusive stepfather kicked Ariel and her sister out of their home when Ariel was around 12. She bounced between foster homes and guardianships over the next 6 years. And that's where we'll start our conversation. What was foster care like?
It was kind of a kick in the face at first, in my opinion. I mean, I was a teenager. I was in middle school. It was very confusing at first to understand. I mean, obviously going into somebody's home that you don't even know. I remember my first home being kind of in the rough area of my hometown, and I didn't really know what to expect. So kind of going into the home, it was kind of a different change for me, and it set off a lot of emotions, I think, because it was just all new, and I just didn't understand.
What kind of emotions?
I think I was angry, mainly because of like the past that I went through with my family and my family members. And then I got angry at people that I necessarily shouldn't have gotten angry at. But I think it was mainly coming from a deeper level because I was just so confused, and I didn't know, you know, like where my life stood at that point. I didn't know what my future was going to be because I was just, I felt like I was almost at my lowest point, and I didn't really know what to expect moving on. I didn't know what was going to happen the next day.
And then you turn 18. What happened then?
Well, it's kind of difficult for me because I was in a guardianship for my whole entire high school years. I was in the same home. I was under a guardianship. Guardianship is almost adoption, but not necessarily. Guardianship is when they have the rights over the child. They have the rights over the foster child, but they're not adopted, if that makes sense. But I wasn't getting any financial help. I wasn't getting emotional help on what I needed to succeed and push myself to, you know, get to college and to start being an adult. There was no push. I was doing everything for myself. I was working. I worked at a fast food restaurant, and I paid for all of my clothing. I paid for all of my activities, even when it came to buying things for school. I ended up buying them myself. So,
and it sounds between the lines, I think I'm hearing not only did you not get a lot of financial support, I don't think I'm hearing that you got a lot of emotional support.
Exactly. And I think I needed that, especially my senior year. And that's kind of where everything went downhill with the guardianship. I petitioned the courts. I went to the courthouse and I petitioned the courts to revoke my guardianship because I wanted to be put in the system because there were financial things that would be able to be given to me if I did enter the system.
So you turn 18, Ariel, and what was there for you as you are now considered an adult? What was there for you and what was not?
Well, for me, I think it was difficult because I was transitioning back into foster care when I turned 18. And so literally, like, if my documents hadn't been legalized for like at least like a week more, I wouldn't have gotten a lot of the benefits. So when it came to the different scholarships that I was like able to use for college, it was a close call, and I was almost not able to use it. But
what did you have? What support and assistance did you have to get into Wayne State, to get to college?
So originally when I had applied for Wayne State, I didn't apply until my senior year. I didn't apply to like the second semester. It was like almost time's up to apply, and I hurried up and did it really quick. But they accepted me through a program, a bridge program, because my GPA was low my senior year. It was a 2.2. But Wayne accepted me through a bridge program called APEX. And basically, I came here for 8 weeks during the summer, and I took college courses, basically 16-week classes, and we crammed them into 8 weeks. And I was able to come into Wayne with a GPA, like a college GPA, which was able for me to get a scholarship through a program called the HIGH program. And with that, they were able to give me a free semester of housing.
So you proved yourself. You proved yourself by coming in that summer program. And
yes.
Saying,
and I mean,
can do this.
That summer program taught me so much. I was not expecting so much like help. I know that if I had not joined the summer program, I would not be doing Kennedy College. I was not ready, especially when it came to, you know, procrastination and, you know, college effort and putting in the time and time management. I was not physically ready and I was not prepared. And APEX really set me up and gave me the skills and gave me the connections to people on campus that can help me.
Ariel, when you think of people that you've come to know, classmates at Wayne, for instance, who did not go through the system, did not go through what you had to do from the time you were very young, how do you compare? What do they have and you look and go, man, I wish I had that?
So actually, this is a funny question, in my opinion, because even in high school, I always looked and I always had that question in the back of my head, but in college, I feel so different because I'm more free. I think in high school, I kind of looked at that question more and I kind of looked at people and I almost judged them because, you know, they at the end of the day, they had people to go home to or, you know, they had family that supported them. And I think that for me, it was harder because I did do things in school and I yet still had nobody like come to them. Like even with my singing and I did choir and, you know, having nobody come to my concerts. I mean, as a kid, it kind of wears down on you, but I think it set me up for college in the smallest way possible. And I didn't think it would until I finally realized it here in college. I think it's a different experience because it's the connection that the other people have with you also, because I mean, they're also here. And at the end of the day, I mean, I'm here for an education. And I think that the friends that I've made here are on the same track and their goals are just as high as mine. And I think that that was what I needed. And in high school, I didn't have that. And so now that I'm here in college and, you know, they're here getting an education, I'm here getting an education. So at the end of the day, we're here to help each other out, not break each other down.
Ariel, this report that recently came out looking at how Michigan does for young people when they age out of foster care. This report looked across all 50 states and found only 3% of young people in Michigan in foster care get support through employment or vocational training. Whereas, like in West Virginia, 70% of transitioning young people get scholarships. So you're kind of in that 3% rarity when you think of that you are getting some support to get through college. What do you want Michigan lawmakers to understand about what it's like, you know, to turn 18 after years in the state's foster care system?
So, coming from me, I think the thing that needs to be put out there the most is that these people that are aging out into the system, they don't know what to expect. For me growing up, I didn't know what I was even going to make it this far. I didn't know that I was going to graduate. I didn't see that next day because I was so worried about, you know, where I was moving next or if I was going to be getting kicked out or if I was being moved. So I think that the biggest thing for me, it was the weight off my shoulder as soon as I graduated. Because as soon as I graduated, the percentage of high school students to graduate that have been in foster care rose. I applied for college and I got accepted to college. That raised the percentage of foster kids that enter college. There are scholarships and there is money to be given to these kids that age out. But I think the biggest thing is they need that help. They need that person behind them, guiding them, kind of giving them a little bit of help in the beginning to kind of push them and say, hey, you can do this. You can accomplish this. They just need that little bit of guidance, I think. At the end of the day, I think for most of it is they just need that push. And I got that push. So I think that's how I made it.
And who was that person for you? Who was that entity that gave you that push?
So with Michigan DHS, I don't know if it's around nationally, but I know in Michigan, we do a thing called MYOI, which is Michigan Youth Opportunities Initiative. Basically, it's a program for Michigan teen youth that are in foster care that need that guidance and that need that kind of training. They need those skills that their parents would teach them, but since they're in the system, they don't have those people to guide them and teach them how to grow up and be a teenager. So you gather together, it's different teens. You have dinner together and you have an activity based on like something you need to learn. Like we did, like how to fill out a checkbook, how to pay bills, how to make a monthly budget, how to do laundry. So Michigan Opportunities Initiative, it really set me up and it gave me the information that I needed for all of the scholarships. We talked about all of the scholarships that you're eligible for, what ages you can be up to, how much money it is, where to get them, how to sign up, when to do it. And so I was pushed to do these after I graduated. And so I think that's what set me up for all of the help for college.
Ariel, what are your career goals? What are you studying and what do you want to do?
So I am majoring in music right now. I was going to go in undecided at first, but I am a singer, actually. In high school, I was in my choir and I did a couple of talent shows, but I really want to pursue my singing voice. And it's a hobby of mine. And I want a career that I'm going to enjoy and love. So, yeah.
Well, Ariel Duncan, we want to thank you so much for sharing your life and your experiences with us, and the best of luck as you continue through Wayne State University with your music studies.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure to get that out there.
Tune in to Stateside tomorrow as we talk with two siblings who were separated in foster care and hear why they say Michigan and the U.S. need a sibling bill of rights. Today's Stateside was directed by Lindsay Scullin, engineered by Peg Watson. Our executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. Contributors are Mike Blank, Mercedes Mejia, April Van Buren, Sam Corey, Joey Horan, and Natalie Brennan. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so very much for listening.